On the evening of August 26, 2020, the first part of a series of online community fora on topics related to the COVID-19 pandemic was held. Sponsored by the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society at Montana State University Bozeman, it was titled Spillover: Understanding the Origins of Pandemics. It featured presentations by award-winning author David Quammen, whose 2012 book, Spillover: Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, warned of coming pandemics, and Dr. Raina Plowright, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, who specializes in the dynamics of infectious diseases and the process of pathogen spillover from animals to humans. Professor Kristen Intiman of the MSU History and Philosophy Department and Director of the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society moderated the discussion.
Welcome to Spillover, Understanding the Origins of Pandemics. This is actually the first of a monthly series that we are kicking off tonight of online events that are aimed at exploring the science, ethics, and political implications of the COVID-19 pandemic and how it impacts with communities around Montana. I'm Kristen Intiman. I'm a professor of philosophy at Montana State University, and I'm also the director for the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, which is an interdisciplinary, nonpartisan, university-wide initiative at Montana State, which is funded by the Office of Research, Economic Development, and Graduate Education. We want to start by thanking Vice President Jason Carter for his ongoing support for this initiative. I also would like to just thank Michael Reedy, Professor of History at MSU, and he's an Associate Director for our initiative. And Nika Stoop, who's also helping to moderate tonight, who is the Program Manager for our initiative. So thanks to both of them for their help in monitoring this event and also helping me hopefully prevent any technical problems. Tonight, we're really privileged to have two internationally recognized scholars and researchers who will each give 15-minute presentations on the science behind spillover events where zoonotic infections are transmitted to humans, much like in COVID-19. We will then have about a half an hour for questions from attendees. It is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, well-known science writer David Quammen. He's the author of 16 books, both fiction and nonfiction, including Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, which perhaps eerily, in retrospect, was published in 2012. And he also has authored numerous essays in a variety of publications, such as Harper's, National Geographic, Outside, Esquire, The Atlantic, Powder, and Rolling Stone. In May, his work appeared in The New Yorker, where he wrote about why we were not ready for the pandemic with coronavirus. And this week, fresh hot off the press, is in the August 31st issue of The New Yorker. He has an essay entitled, Did Pangolin Trafficking Cause the Coronavirus Pandemic? It's a fantastic piece. There's also an audio version of it. I encourage you to go check that out. He was a Guggenheim Fellow, and he also received the Lannan Literary Award for nonfiction. And he served a term in my very own department as the Wallace Segner Professor of Western American Studies at Montana State University from 2007 to 2009. I should mention in my own household, he's also known as the cool guy that got to be in the CNN coronavirus town hall with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. We're very grateful that he can join us this evening, and it's my pleasure to introduce David Quammen.
Thank you very much, Kristen. Thank you, and Michael, and all of you for inviting me to be part of this. I'm really glad, and I see that we've got a nice turnout. We've got more than 200 people in the room with us. It's very gratifying. I'm delighted to be part of this first of these fora from MSU on COVID-19. And it's good to be tag teaming with Raina. Raina and I are old friends. And this will be, I hope, very comfortable. I think we'll complement one another. I'll talk about some fundamentals, first of all, and then I'll talk a little bit about how those fundamentals apply, fundamentals of this kind of disease. And then I'll talk about a bit about how those fundamentals apply in particular to COVID-19. And then Raina will talk about the doing of the science. I'm not a scientist. I'm somebody who follows scientists, describes scientists, and their work. I write about science increasingly the last 6 months. I talk about science. Raina actually does science and teaches science. So we'll complement one another that way. Let me start then with this in terms of fundamentals. One of the very first and most far-reaching things that can be said about COVID-19 is simply that it is a zoonotic disease. Now, Kristen mentioned that term, zoonosis, zoonotic disease. A zoonotic disease, what does that mean? A zoonotic disease is a disease caused by a zoonosis, an animal infection that's transmissible to humans, a bug of some sort. It can be a virus, it could be a bacterium, could be a fungus, some sort of an infectious microbe transmissible from non-human animals to humans. That's the case with COVID-19. How do we know that's the case with COVID-19? Well, scientists very early on, in late December, early January, found a virus that is causing this syndrome. And they sequenced the genome of that virus, found that it was a coronavirus, and it was a novel coronavirus, never before seen in humans, never before known to affect humans. So if it has never been seen in humans, where does it come from? Well, everything comes from somewhere. Viruses must have hosts. Every virus can only replicate itself, can only function as a living or quasi-living creature rather than a little dormant pill if it's inside the cell of a cellular living creature. That means inside the cells of an animal, a plant, a fungus, a bacterium, some other sort of a cellular creature. So we know that this virus has never been seen in humans before, therefore it comes from a host. Almost certainly we knew immediately from an animal host, because the viruses that infect wildlife are much more likely to be able to infect humans as well. So the search immediately began to solve that question. Where did this come from? The third thing about knowing that this is a zoonotic disease is the question of what does that imply? Well, it implies that this disease, this virus, has come to us through some sort of a contact with a wild animal, a population of wild animals, some sort of an interaction, some sort of a disruptive contact with wild animals. And therefore, it's important to do the sort of detective work that Raina and her colleagues, a whole passel of whom I describe in my spillover, it's important to do the detective work that they do, which is to find out where exactly this particular virus came from, what wild animal it came from, and under what circumstances it passed from the wild animal into humans. Let me just lay down a couple of other quick definitions to get us all on the same page. That moment when a zoonotic agent, a zoonotic virus, passes from its non-human host into its first human victim, that's what we call spillover. That's the moment of spillover. The virus gets into a new kind of host, and if it finds that it can replicate in that host, it finds that it can transmit from one individual of that host to another, then we have what's called an outbreak. It might be a cluster of just a dozen or two dozen cases of this new disease, this new syndrome, in some sort of a remote place, a village in Africa or a town in China, someplace like that. If an outbreak spreads, transmission is very successful from human to human. It explodes across a country. That we call that an epidemic. And if it gets on airplanes in a capital city and starts flying around the world, spreading to other countries, then what we have is a pandemic. Now, another thing that's important to know about COVID-19 is that this is not a unique event. This is not a terrible catastrophe that came out of nowhere and is simply happening to us. This is part of a pattern. It's part of a pattern that's been going on for quite a while, and it's a pattern that reflects things that we humans are doing, ways in which we are having contact, disruptive contact, with wild animals, with the natural world, in a way that gives viruses from non-human animals a chance, an opportunity to get into humans. Viruses don't seek us out. They have no intentionality. They have no desire to infect humans. but they follow the Darwinian imperatives. A virus is a creature subject to Darwinian imperatives, and that means the survival of the fittest. It has been programmed to replicate itself, to expand itself in abundance, to expand itself in geographical space, and to expand itself in time, to make itself a Darwinian success. And this virus is certainly a Darwinian success. So I said this is part of a pattern. I call this the drumbeat of previous zoonotic spillovers, some of which turned into outbreaks, epidemics, even pandemics. You can trace them back to 1961, at least. I mean, some of these are very old. It's a phenomenon that goes back to the bubonic plague. As long as humans have been humans interacting with wildlife, as hunter-gatherers, we were coming in contact with wild animals and presumably being infected by their viruses. But in terms of the recent history, the modern phenomenon, the accelerating pace of this pattern, I see it beginning with Machupo virus in 1961, causing Bolivian hemorrhagic fever in Bolivia, coming out of rodents and getting into humans. And then there was Marburg, a cousin of Ebola virus in 1967, that passed from monkeys shipped up from Uganda to Marburg, Germany for research purposes, made people sick and killed people, 67. Then Ebola itself, first known spillover was in 1976 in Congo and Sudan. HIV/AIDS has been with us longer than we would suspect, but was recognized in 1981. 1992, some of the older folks among us, and even not so old, remember in 1992, the mysterious, very scary, spooky outbreak of hantavirus in the Four Corners area of the American Southwest. 1994, a virus called Hendra virus came out of bats in Australia in a very, very strange way that Raina will talk about because this is her specialty. She is the world expert on Hendra virus. 1997, avian flu, H5N1, avian flu out of Hong Kong. Nipah virus, 1998, in Bangladesh, coming out of bats again. West Nile virus, 1999. The first SARS, 2003, also a coronavirus that passed to us from bats and then spread to the world from the Hong Kong airport. Going on, it's the swine flu of 2009. MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, another coronavirus, 2012, coming out of bats, passing through dromedary camels into humans on the Arabian Peninsula. Zika, you probably remember Zika in 2015. And now we have SARS-CoV-2, this new virus, another coronavirus in 2020, 2019 and 20. Also probably coming originally out of a bat. The reservoir host seems to be a bat that had been carrying a virus, carrying a number of coronaviruses similar to this in southern and central China. Now, to COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2 in particular, here's just a little bit before I finish and pass it to Raina on what we know about that. We know that this virus almost certainly comes from bats because it is a 96% match to a coronavirus that was identified in bats in 2013, a virus that's been known. People have warned about it for 7, 8, 10 years. This particular virus was identified in a bat in the province of Yunnan, adjacent to Hubei province, where the city of Wuhan is, where this began. So 96% similar, but 96% is not an exact match to this virus. This coronavirus, again, that has been found in bats in Yunnan province, 96% similar to the current virus in humans. What does that imply? It implies both that this virus originated in bats, but that it has a history of perhaps 40 or 50 years of evolutionary divergence from the closest bat virus that we know. Now, it might have spent that 40 or 50 years in another population of bats, separate, migrationally distinct, apart from the virus bat population that's known. It might have spent some of that time in a pangolin, this wonderful kind of creature that's loosely known as a scaly anteater, looks like an armadillo and behaves like an anteater, but really belongs to a group of animals unique to themselves. That's what my current story in The New Yorker just out this week. That's what that's about. It's about the possibility that this virus spent some of its time evolving in pangolins before passing into humans. The evidence on that is very complicated, molecular biology. The opinions on it differ as to whether pangolins were involved or not involved, whether it may have come from bats. But all of these things are part of what scientists are working on now, trying to figure out where this virus came from and how it got into humans. What did we do, we humans do, that caused a virus with such dangerous potential against which scientists had been warning the world for 10 years or 15 years, coronaviruses carried by bats, SARS-like coronaviruses. Those warnings went unheeded. This virus passed into humans, and we need to know how and why. Why do we need to know how and why? Partly because it may help us in terms of the development of therapeutics and vaccines against this particular virus. Even more importantly, because it will help us defend against another spillover like this that could lead to another pandemic. This is not the last. This is only the current one that we are dealing with. Again, part of a larger pattern that reflects things that we humans have been doing. And with that, why don't I stop and pass it over to Raina?
Thank you so much, David. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Raina Plowright, who is an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Montana State University. She's an internationally recognized expert in the transmission of pathogens from vertebrate animals to humans. And in particular, as David mentioned, she examines how small changes in one part of a zoonotic system can have profound consequences for human health and for wildlife health as well. And her NSF-funded research looks at exactly how that occurs in bats. And indeed, her research was used as a source for David Quammen's book, Spillover. She has a veterinary degree from the University of Sydney. She received an MS in epidemiology in 2015 and a PhD in 2017 in ecology from the University of California, Davis. She's the author and co-author of over 70 peer-reviewed articles in a variety of prestigious journals. Just to mention a couple of those, Nature Reviews, PLOS Pathogens, PLOS Neglected Tropical Diseases, Vaccines, Ecology Letters, Biology Letters, the Journal of Animal Ecology, and Ecological Monographs, and the Proceedings of the Royal Society. She has lectured all over the world and currently serves on multiple board of advisors regarding emerging infections and bat zoonosis. And so we're very lucky that we have her here in Bozeman, and it's my pleasure to turn things over to Dr. Raina Plowright.
Thank you for the introduction and for the invitation to speak. And David, you just set me up so well. Thanks so much. That's excellent. I'm going to discuss pandemics. How do they start? Why do they take off? Why does it matter? And how do we stop them from happening again? I lead a team of around 70 people, and we're focused on diseases that emerge from bats into humans. Why bats? Well, I think David set that up nicely, that drumbeat that he talked about. Many of those pathogens have a bat origin. So we're trying to develop the scientific basis for preventing spillover from happening in the first place. So let's start where it all began. We'll start with a bat. This is actually a black flying fox that we're feeding mango juice after it's woken up from its anesthetic in the field. Bats are incredible animals. They're the only mammals that fly. They're critical pollinators. They're huge insect eaters, and they live for decades. This is a Brands bat. It weighs about 5 grams, so the weight of a nickel, and it's been found to live up to 41 years. There are about 1,400 species of bats. And many of them have these pathogens. They host pathogens that are very virulent or fatal to us, but they don't make bats sick. And we're trying to understand why that is. But one hypothesis is that it's related to their ability to fly, certain mechanisms that allow them to withstand sustained flight. So how do pandemics start? Well, for SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen that causes COVID-19, we don't know. And I think David he pretty much gave the state of the art in terms of our, that's the state of the knowledge of what happened. We know that it was probably from a Chinese horseshoe bat, but we can't tell you really what happened. But I can tell you about how other pathogens can spill over. So let me start with Nipah virus. Pteropus medius here is the host of Nipah virus. Nipah is another zoonotic bat virus. It has a fatality rate between 50 and 100% in humans. And we worry about it in places like Bangladesh that have high human population density and poor public health capacity. And every time these pathogens spill over, it's a roll of the dice towards having the right genotype that can take off and spread in those populations. In Bangladesh, spillover happens through date palm sap collection. So these guys, they climb up the trees, they put a big gash in the side of the tree, and then the date palm sap drips slowly into this collection pot, which is sold on the street the next day. But meanwhile, this is a Pteropus medius bat licking the date palm sap as it drips into the pot. And if you watch very carefully, it pees right into the pot. And we can trace the outbreaks of Nipah virus by tracing the roots of the date palm sap sellers. So here you can see a road where this date palm sap seller walked along selling date palm sap. And these little dots here are cases of Nipah virus that occurred, all of them incredibly tragic. And then Hendra virus in Australia, and David mentioned this, it's also a bat-borne virus transmitted to horses when bats are feeding in trees in horse paddocks and horses graze the contaminated ground. And then horses transmit it to humans. And David said something about the strange way that this burst out into our consciousness. And that was an outbreak actually in 1994. Where 20 horses were infected in a racing stable in the middle of Brisbane, so one of our capital cities in Australia. And a famous racehorse trainer died from the pathogen. His assistant was infected but recovered. And if it wasn't for such a spectacular outbreak, we may not have discovered Hendra virus until much later. So how do we then delineate the origins of this new pathogen that we're all experiencing right now? So we know, as David eloquently described, there are other coronaviruses in bats that are very similar, and that these ones have been found in Yunnan province, in northern Vietnam, Laos, Myanmar, in this region of the world. So what happened at the beginning? Well, coronaviruses infect the gastrointestinal tract of bats. So they're excreted in feces. So we know there must have been an infected bat and it must have excreted the virus in its feces. And then that virus had to survive for long enough for a person or another host to come along and be exposed. Perhaps it was a guano digger in Yunnan province that then jumped on a train to Wuhan. Perhaps a bat was brought into a market. Maybe it even infected another animal, and then that animal was transported to the seafood market in Wuhan that became the epicenter of the early outbreak. And why do pandemics, why do they take off? One of the big questions that is within the field of zoonotic disease emergence is, was SARS-CoV-2 supercritical in bats? Now, what does that even mean? Well, to explain, I need to explain the concept of R0, or the reproductive number. The reproductive number, which we're hearing in the media now, so there's a lot of literacy around this concept, it's the average number of infections that one infected person will produce in their infectious period at the beginning of an outbreak. If R0 is greater than one, a pathogen can take off and spread. If it's less than one, but greater than zero, we can get stuttering chains of transmission. So short chains of transmission that eventually stutter out but never actually take off. So originally we thought that SARS-CoV-2 in bats may have needed to have a genetic mix-up in another host before it was supercritical in humans. But recent evidence suggests maybe that's not the case. Maybe actually this pathogen is circulating in bats ready to take off and spread. And it could potentially go directly from bats into humans. But we have a lot of questions there that still need to be addressed. Many of the pathogens we work on are not supercritical. So Nipah, for example, the Nipah virus in Bangladesh I just talked about. This is actually from India here. Nipah virus is subcritical. R0 is less than one. And the reason for that, there are many reasons, but some of the major reasons is people infected with Nipah cannot transmit the pathogen until they are sick. and they are very sick, severely ill, and very quickly. The fatality rate, as I mentioned, can approach 100% in some outbreaks. But that means that sick people are quickly isolated, taken out of that transmission chain, and then classic epidemiology, which is a detecting infected people, contact tracing, can control these outbreaks. SARS Classic, or SARS-1, the original SARS outbreak that spread through the world in 2003, it was supercritical. So it could take off and spread in humans, but we were also able to control that for similar reasons as for Nipah, in that people did not spread the original SARS virus until they were sick. And again, we could identify sick people, and then we could isolate them and stop the outbreak. What about SARS-CoV-2? SARS-CoV-2, unfortunately, is the Goldilocks virus. We didn't really know this until probably a month into the pandemic. I think it was around the 31st of January. And I remember the moment I learned about the pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic transmission. I was actually in Bangladesh. I was at the airport standing in line to board, not that I'd call it a line. I was surrounded by people. Everyone's coughing because the air is almost toxic to breathe. And someone texted me, a colleague texted me, this New England Journal of Medicine paper showing a case series from Germany where a Chinese businesswoman had flown to Germany and had a series of meetings. And through the epidemiology, they discovered that some of the transmission events that occurred happened before people had symptoms. And that knowledge changed everything, I think, for the whole epidemiology community. And I remember that moment. I remember my heart was racing. And I had an N95 mask in my bag, and I put that on immediately, and I wore that for the way home. But I knew that this was going to be everywhere. We also knew R0 was between 2 and 4 at that point in time. So why does it matter to Montana? When I first came to MSU, I was constantly asked, what do bat viruses have to do with Montana? And, well, all I can think to say now is that I think all of us have had our lives disrupted by a virus that until about 10 months ago was happily living in the gastrointestinal tract of a bat in Asia. In Montana, we like to think of ourselves as rural, wide, but really well connected with the world. And this virus has gone to every country bar 10 island nations. This is a list of deaths in Houston in one city yesterday. And we need to multiply that by nearly 1,000 to understand the impact that's happening right now within our communities. And I know the effect of these tragedies personally. So in 1918, my grandmother and my great-grandparents were infected with the Spanish influenza. And they were brought into a makeshift hospital in a school. And my great-grandfather died. And he left his wife with 8 children. My grandmother was a baby at the time. And then they had to fend for themselves through the Great Depression. And it had a profound impact on their lives, my life probably too, and also many others around the world. So how do we stop pandemics from happening again? Well, first, it will happen again, and we should be prepared. When we need to develop the capacity to do the science, to do the surveillance, and to respond rapidly when they happen. But where do we focus the efforts? The world's a big place, and we know that there are thousands and thousands of potentially zoonotic pathogens within wildlife. So we know that emergence events tend to happen in high biodiversity regions, and they tend to happen in places that are threatened by environmental degradation. Here's where coronaviruses are found in bats. Almost global distribution, 3,000 variants, around 200 SARS-like variants there. So how do we even tackle such a huge and complex question? Well, one thing that we can do is we can start looking at places where spillover happens a lot. Firstly, with the coronaviruses, 3 coronaviruses have emerged into the human population, causing large outbreaks, epidemics or pandemics in the last 20 years. So SARS Classic, SARS-1. From civets to people, MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, from camels to people, from bats to camels to people, and SARS-CoV-2 from bats to, we don't know. But that is N=3. How can we understand spillover when we've had 3 events and we haven't recognized even that spillover occurred until there were already massive outbreaks within the human population? And so it was hard to go back and reconstruct the events. So what we need to do is we need to go to systems where spillover is regular We need to try to find how it happens, understand it, so that we can then start working on systems with less data. So we work in Bangladesh on Nipah virus and Hendra virus in Australia, and every dot here is a spillover event or even a number of spillover events. So you can see that we have a lot, N equals around 60 in Australia and many more in Bangladesh. So how do we do this? We go to the source. We study the bats, and what we try to do is study the pathogens in the wildlife reservoir populations before they reach the human populations. So we have teams in the field. This is a graduate student at MSU. We hoist up these big nets and we catch the bats in the nets as they come back from their feeding. It's very, very noisy early in the morning as thousands of bats are returning to the roost. This guy here is a crocus palm fruit and he's not going to let go of. So we take a blood sample. We put a bat under an anesthetic. Every bat has an anesthetic. We take a blood sample, and that blood then is used to do a bunch of immunological assays to understand their health. We look at the parasites in the blood. Much of this is irradiated and then brought to MSU. And of course, we collect urine because that's where we actually find these viruses. The Nipah viruses are in urine. And then after we're finished, we wake the bats up from anesthetic and they're released back into the colony. And sometimes we have to be very creative about how we catch bats. So this area was crocodile infested, so we couldn't work on the banks of the river. So we actually worked on the river itself, catching bats again with a big net hoisted on the boat here. The bat flies into the net and then we bring the net down. We put the bat into a pillowcase and then it has an anesthetic and a blood test later. And to understand spillover, an important part of this is the behavior of bats, the behavior of humans as well as the behavior of bats. So we put these trackers on bats and we look at where they go. And we actually found this study run by a PhD student, Maureen Kessler, showing that bats are more likely to feed in agricultural areas when their native food is not available. And often this work, it's like a needle in a haystack. We'll go back again and again and we won't find virus. We will find very, very little virus. And then all of a sudden, we will find a lot of virus. And it's usually when the bats are stressed because of some sort of environmental perturbation, often linked to the lack of habitat. And if we can then understand through all these data how spillover happens and why, we can start to predict it. And then we can make warnings, like these warnings to the chief veterinary officers in Australia, telling people to vaccinate their horses for Hendra virus. But even more so, if we understand the mechanisms driving spillover, we can suggest sustainable solutions. So we've discovered that the loss of winter flowering habitat in Australia is the key trigger to the whole cascade that leads to spillover. So we're working now with governments to replant, rewild this winter habitat. And we actually believe that this will work to reduce the rate of spillovers. So like the pandemic of 2018, we're all living in this really unique time, moment of history, really. It's challenging. It's terrible. It's very, very, very difficult, but it's also not the last pandemic of our lifetime. There's a high chance we're going to see more of these. So our goal is to understand how these things happen, how these events all happen, so that we can then stop that next one from occurring in the first place. Thank you.
Thanks to both of our speakers. It's amazing we have over 300 participants watching live now. We have lots of questions, so I'm going to try to relay some of those. So first of all, both of you talked about, obviously, how spillover events can happen from animals. But as you're both probably aware, there also have been concerns about the possibility of whether viruses can also escape from labs and that can also be a cause potentially of pandemics. One of our attendees noted that there was a recent article by Lanthrum and Wilson chronicling the history of viruses that escape from research labs across the globe. Do you think that's something that we should also be directing our attention to? What might either of you have to say about concerns about labs versus concerns about spillover events?
The questioner asked if we're familiar with an article by Latham and Wilson on virus escape from labs and the claim or the accusation that this virus escaped from a lab. Yes, I am familiar with that. It was an article that appeared at a website called Independent Science News in early June, Jonathan Latham and Allison Wilson. And it's not a peer-reviewed scientific article. It's an essay, and it raises the question of whether this virus possibly escaped from a lab run by a scientist named Dr. Zhengli Shi at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. I think I mentioned her earlier. She is a scientist whose group has been studying coronaviruses in bats for 15 years. She was the one who found the particular bat coronavirus that has been labeled RATG13. I call it RATG13. That's the one that's 96% similar to this virus. Dr. Shi makes a point in a recent Q&A with the journal Science that came out in late July. One of the leading reporters at the journal Science, John Cohen, did a Q&A with her. He asks this same question. He says people have said, well, did this escape from your lab? She makes the point that that virus, RATG13, 96% similar to this one, she knows of that only by having taken samples, fecal swabs and saliva swabs from bats in a cave in Yunnan, and having pieced together the genome sequence from those fecal swabs. She did not grow this virus in her laboratory. She says, we have only the genome sequence and didn't isolate this virus. That means that there never was living RATG13 virus in her lab, merely the genomic sequence of it, which is what she was studying at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So people can say, people can worry, people can accuse about the possibility of a lab escape, but the fact is there is zero evidence in support of that hypothesis, and there is testimony from the critical scientists in the journal Science contrary to that.
That's a brilliant answer. And I don't have a lot to add, but I'd say that in science, we often don't have we can't directly observe what's happening. We can never directly observe that spillover event from a bat to a human and say that's definitively what happened. We have to amass evidence. So it's almost like in a case in law where you have a defendant, you never saw them do the murder, but their fingerprints were found on the knife and they had a motive. And so if you piece together all of the evidence, there are over 3,000 coronaviruses in bats. We know of probably a couple of hundred that are of SARS-like. And there are so many encounters with bats, between bats and humans, so many opportunities, probably thousands a day, for spillover events to happen. So the parsimonious explanation is that this has come from nature. And again, as David said, they're actually really hard viruses to isolate. So the SARS classic wasn't isolated for 10 years, or a similar virus was not isolated from bats for 10 years after the outbreak happened. So we're generally dealing with sequences and not actually live virus. It just is very, very unlikely.
Great. So we have actually two questions that I think are a little bit interrelated about our relationships, human relationships with animals. So Don Granger asked a question about what your views are regarding the regulation of wild animal markets and how might that be done. And we have another attendee, Tatiana, that asked, in the light of spillovers and that they're caused from animal hosts, would becoming vegetarian lessen the possibility of future outbreaks? So anything regarding wet markets or vegetarianism as part of the solution?
Well, I know that eating meat is associated with land, a loss of native habitats for wild animals through extensive clearing. And we see many, many zoonoses that are related to landscape clearing. So I'd say that, yes, I think eating less meat would probably cause less opportunities for fragmentations of habitat that then creates opportunities for people and wild animals to mix. And David, I'll let you tackle the wildlife market.
Okay, well, the wet markets of China itself has now taken steps to shut down the so-called quote-unquote wet markets. What's crucial about these wet markets is that they are selling live wildlife in cages for food, which is very dangerous. Everyone agrees on that. If you capture wildlife from the wild, as opposed to captive bred and raised wildlife, bamboo rats or something else, but if you capture wildlife from the wild, put it in cages, bring it into a wet market where you're also selling seafood and pork and beef and poultry, live and dead, then that's a very, very dangerous situation. It's a wonderful opportunity for viruses to spill over from one kind of animal, from a wild animal, into a domestic animal, onto a surface, and to get into people. It's important, I think, to recognize, though, that although we've heard from the beginning that this outbreak, this pandemic began in a wet market in the city of Wuhan, China, the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, actually, it's recognized now that it did not begin there, that it was probably carried into that market not by a wild animal, but by an infected human. The very first identified case of this new syndrome, the first positive person, showed symptoms and was hospitalized on December 1st of 2019, and that person had no known contact whatsoever with the wet market. So this suggests that this virus was circulating in humans as early as the month of November of last year or earlier, passing slowly and undetected, mostly undetected, from human to human, and then began registering as some people got sick and were hospitalized, and then was carried into the wet market, probably by a human. A crowded market, lots of people elbow to elbow buying things, an excellent place for human-to-human transmission. That said, the wildlife is a problem. And as to the question of whether if we all became vegetarians or became moved toward vegetarianism and ate less meat, would that help to reduce the danger of spillover? I agree with Raina. It certainly would help. And yet it's important to remember that the eating of wild animals or the eating even of domestic animals raised in industrial scale is not the only factor that brings animal viruses closer to humans. Every decision we make, every choice we make, what we eat, what we wear, what we consume, how much fossil fuel we burn, how much we travel, all of those things have impacts on the natural world that bring viruses closer to us. If we own one of these, if we own a cell phone, if we own one of these, a computer, we are customers for tantalum capacitors, necessary components of those that are made with the use of a mineral called coltan that is mined in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo in a place where workers are virtually obliged to eat bushmeat. So by being a customer for one of these, we commission laborers to go in and expose themselves to zoonotic viruses on our behalf with the possibility that the next pandemic will begin there. There's enough responsibility to go around, even to vegetarians.
Great, thanks. So we have a couple of different questions about things like adaptations, antibodies, and vaccines. So I'm going to try to hit a couple of those. So the first one is a question from Frankie Wilmer, and she noted, David, that you mentioned the survival of the fittest, you know, as sort of this Darwinian imperative, which she views survival through adaptation. And so obviously we know that a virus won't survive, right, if it actually kills its host or kills too many of its hosts. And Frankie's wondering if both David and Raina, if you could comment on that in relation to SARS-CoV-2.
Frankie, thank you for the question. It's a good and important question, and we're glad for the opportunity to answer it. Some people say, well, the first rule of a successful parasite is don't kill your host, and these infections are forms of parasite. First rule of a successful parasite is don't kill your host. Actually, no. The first rule of a successful parasite is don't kill your host until you've had a chance to transmit to other individuals of that host species. Now, this virus has a very low case fatality rate and a very, very high transmissibility, which is what it has allowed it to become one of the world's most successful viruses right now. People say, well, is it mutating? Is it going to mutate and adapt in new ways? Well, all viruses mutate constantly as they replicate. That's a truism. They're constantly mutating. Most of those are dead ends that go nowhere. Occasionally, a virus mutates in such a way that happens to be adaptive, maybe makes it a little bit more transmissible. Becoming more virulent is probably not adaptive because killing a greater percentage of your host in most cases does not allow you to transmit better and achieve better Darwinian success. But a virus can mutate and, if it's lucky, find itself with a new adaptation that might make it more transmissible or might make it, for instance, capable of getting around a vaccine. Now, this virus doesn't need to adapt much because it's already so successful. And the scientists who track its genomic changes have been saying that it doesn't seem to have adapted very drastically because it doesn't need to. It's succeeding so well. But if we have a vaccine, then there will be a challenge to which it may respond with new evolutionary adaptation.
This is actually a question from Dr. Alan Wanderer. I think many of us have probably heard about the documentation that's come from a couple of places about cases of reinfection in one individual. So somebody who was documented to have been infected with COVID-19, who then several months later has now been, appears to be reinfected. And so do you think that this is caused by an inadequate neutralizing antibody response from the first infection, or is that also perhaps the result of a mutation?
So there were early reports of people testing positive for a long period of time, maybe weeks, even a couple of months. And so there was early theories perhaps that maybe they were being reinfected or they're infected for a long period of time. But that was pretty clearly shown to be that they were infectious probably for only a very short period of time, but had genetic material of the virus still within their upper respiratory tract, testing positive for longer, but not actually infectious. The recent case, so we only have one piece of evidence of reinfection, and that was what was released this week. Unfortunately, it was released as a press release without a paper. And so a couple of days ago, maybe it was 3 days ago, it was a big splash in the media that there was reinfection. There was a photo of the paper that was told to be come out, but no one had a chance to actually look at the data. And so there was a couple of very frustrating days where the epidemiology, immunology community was kind of like, I can't assess this. Another paper was released, I think, this morning. And I've only really seen the headlines. And what I understand is, and I could be wrong because I have not read the paper, but I think there wasn't a neutralizing titer in that first instance of infection, so that they didn't mount an appropriate immune response. And then in the second infection, it was a different strain. And so this makes sense with viruses. Some people don't mount a good immune response and reinfection would be expected. I think what's key is this a one in a million, one in a thousand, one in a hundred? Is this just a rare event that will happen, or is this something that's going to be really common? Also, that second infection, the person did not show symptoms. They're asymptomatic and hopefully not infectious. I don't know that for sure. Maybe the paper will have data on that. But if they're not infectious, then probably doesn't matter so much for the epidemic dynamics. So I still have a few questions, and now I'm regretting I didn't read the paper today.
Actually, Raina, there's another question for you. This one is from Annette Grott. And she asks, can we learn something about how bats respond to the coronavirus in terms of antibodies? Is there any way that could help us in our understanding of vaccines or how to develop vaccines?
I think so. I think there's so much to be learned by bats. I mean, the fact that there's hardly any reports of bats having cancer. They live for so long, given their tiny body size. So they have these incredibly high metabolic rates that allow them to fly. They increase their metabolic rate 16-fold to fly, and then they sustain that. And any other species that was trying to do that would have so much oxidative stress that would cause damage to their cells, damage to their DNA, that they would be really in a bad shape. So not only can bats sustain those sort of metabolic rates without damage to DNA, they don't go into senescence, so they just keep living. They're the size of a mouse, and usually we think about lifespan in terms of size. So a mouse has a lifespan of maybe 2 years, an elephant maybe 70 or more years, and a bat is the size of a mouse, but it has a lifespan of a horse, so 30, 40 years. And so that's all tied up again with their weirdness of what they are doing within their cells, DNA repair, controlling viruses. So I think we really should focus on that. How are they controlling these viruses, not getting sick and not experiencing all the inflammation, all the pathology that we experience? So I agree, there should be a big focus there, but there's probably like 6 bat immunologists in the world. But that's an area that MSU is now becoming quite good at. So we'll hopefully have some answers soon.
So building off that and thinking about vaccines, there's also a question to either one or both of you from Rob Mayer. There are obviously ethical concerns with these so-called challenge trials with vaccines. And so typically ethical physicians and scientists will not experiment by deliberately infecting people with unknown dangerous virus, even if perhaps there's people willing to volunteer for that. Are there other ways to study virus transmission and treatment in humans without resorting to those kind of challenge trials?
I mean, the whole field of epidemiology is built around our inability to do experiments with some pathogens. So for example, it took a long time to figure out that HIV caused AIDS because there wasn't a model animal for experiments. And they couldn't infect a human with HIV to find out whether that went on to develop AIDS. And so the field of epidemiology has developed all of these observational techniques to get at a causal inference. So really getting to understand cause and effect in a very rigorous way. And so we study big populations of people. We study things prospectively through time. So we start with populations that have controls, and then there's some that have the particular, perhaps the high susceptibility to disease, and we watch what happens. We have statistical techniques. So there are very rigorous ways of getting at some of those issues without actually having to do an experiment. And then there's the double blind randomized control trial, of course, where certain interventions take place in certain people and not others. Of course, the best way to causal inference is we could time travel, right? We go back in time and then we see what would happen if we changed one thing, but we can't do that. So we have epidemiology instead.
Just a couple more questions here. Try to get to as many as I can. So Linda Reynolds asked about other animals contracting COVID. We've seen cases of dogs and cats and animals from the zoo in New York and minks in Utah. How problematic is that for our own health, and might it impact, for example, our food supply?
We've heard of cases of cats testing positive for COVID-19 for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, meaning felines of any species, you know, tigers in a zoo, lions in a zoo, domestic cats. More cats than dogs, and my understanding is that's because cats as a family have more of the critically susceptible cell receptors, the enzymes on the outside of certain cells in the respiratory tracts called ACE2 receptors that this virus is particularly well adapted to grabbing onto and using as a point of entry to get into the cells. So cats have these ACE2 receptors in their respiratory tracts. Canids, dogs, less so. Minks, yes. Minks and ferrets, yes. Not just in Utah, but in the Netherlands, there have been a number of cases where mink farms have been devastated by SARS-CoV-2. The virus is carried into a mink farm by a human who is shedding the virus. It gets into the mink. It spreads rampantly among the minks. The minks have to be culled, have to be killed. Of course, these minks are being raised for fur. They're already doomed, but they are killed prematurely to wipe out this virus in a given population and try and prevent it from spreading to another mink population or another mink farm. I've been getting emails and Twitter comments from people in the Netherlands about asking what's going on with our mink. Our mink industry is being devastated. That's because the virus is very capable of infecting mink. Does that represent a further danger to humans that we are likely to become reinfected from minks with another form of this virus? Well, there are already so many humans carrying this virus around, causing so much exposure to other humans that I can't swear to this with scientific certainty, but it seems to me that there's a small additional risk to us from minks. If the virus is in mink, it may be evolving to adapt better to transmission among minks. That does not make it more dangerous to humans when it comes out the other side of the mink population and gets into humans. So again, an interesting question. A question that people are watching. There is science being done on this. I don't know what the final answer is, but it seems to me not the biggest thing for us to worry about right now, unless we are a mink farmer or a mink.
Thanks, David. So we have a few other questions that we weren't able to get to, and in particular, a few that are on testing. But I just want to remind people that our next community forum in this series is actually going to be on testing and surveillance. And so we're going to have both Dr. Blake Wiedenhaft from Montana State University and Dr. Seth Walk, who are going to come and talk about COVID-19 testing and surveillance and the things that they're doing with wastewater testing and the things they're doing to expand the testing capacity in Gallatin County and communities in Montana. Again, just thanks to both David Quammen and Raina Flowright. They're two incredibly busy individuals that are doing lots of important work. So even though you can't hear the big applause, woo! We're really, really grateful.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Nika. Thank you, Stess. Thank you, MSU, for letting us be part of this tonight. And Raina, always great to team with you.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you, everyone.
If you're interested in connecting on September 23rd for our next community web forum on testing and surveillance, you can go again to the Stess website. We'll be advertising and sending out flyers and ad in the Bozeman Chronicle again. So hope to see some of you there. And thanks, everyone. Good night.
You have just heard the first part of a series of online community fora on topics related to the COVID-19 pandemic, created by the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society at Montana State University Bozeman. Held on August 26, 2020, it was titled Spillover: Understanding the Origins of Pandemics. It featured presentations by award-winning author David Quammen, whose 2012 book, Spillover: Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, warned of coming pandemics, and Dr. Raina Plowright, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology, who specializes in the dynamics of infectious diseases and the process of pathogen spillover from animals to humans. Professor Kristen Intiman of the MSU History and Philosophy Department and Director of the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society moderated the discussion. For more information, you can go to montana.edu/STES/. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. Thanks to Professor Kristen Intiman for production assistance.